So because in foreign policy, of course...
Right. So, Professor, that's very interesting you mentioned this, because this brings me to maybe the gist of the whole... the key to understanding a lot of things. We had this European integration process, and I remember you once mentioned the idea of these expectations not really meeting the reality. And in some ways, we maybe have, because we like to talk theoretically, both of us, in terms of our academic background, that maybe we have now come to the understanding that there is such a thing as national interests beyond what this idea of European common interest, that maybe there is going to be some sort of a, maybe not formally, but informally, a split within the European Union.
We're back to another international relations theory. We have this functionalism, that's integration theory.
Exactly.
And the European idea was based on this. So that means you have cooperation on the lower level, science, technology, economy, spill over to political and security, and then common defense and common government. It worked to a certain level,
exactly.
But it does not go all the way. Common defense is no question right now. Common defense policy, yes. Cooperation,
right.
Strategic compass, everything whatever. But it doesn't go to Europe. Doesn't want a common commander, so who decides whether soldiers are going to die?
Exactly.
So and not the common guy. And here, the Europeans have to be realistic and say we have to. Can go to a certain level, and there can be multilateralism on this level, and the European Union can be active. And my favorite example is the GCPOA.
Right.
The GCPOA was after 2015 a masterpiece of multilateralism, but the idea is you have certain member states that can do something, and the European Union would support it. So you need not have the common consensus of all the states.
Right.
Otherwise, it's always an excuse.
Right.
So you can do this on a lower level, and some countries can do it. So the GCPA would be a good example. We will see how it plays out.
Right.
But for the European Union, it's possible that the European Union can do something on a level beneath the common government, beneath the common voice.
I guess my question is this, Professor. Is it really, are these those Western European nations and elites who are pretty much fully invested in NATO and in the alliance with America, are they capable of accepting that a country like Hungary, like Poland, like Germany, might have its own national interest vis-a-vis Russia as opposed to theirs? Maybe you could say, okay, Belgium, what does Belgium have to do with Russia? Okay, we can say that. But there are countries that really their national interest is not to be at war with Russia. I mean, is this something that, because this goes back to the idea of ideology, is the ideology so deep, this Atlanticism, this idea of that, you know, America is the way to go for Europe, particularly after World War II and the horrors of Nazism, the crimes that happened with communism and Stalinism that happened in Eastern Europe. Is Europe capable of having this diversity of interests and handling it?
Of course, the transatlantic bonds are very strong. Of course, we have NATO, but Europeans always think the Americans helped out in the First World War, Second World War, were the leading state during the Cold War against the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union. They closed their eyes during the Vietnam War. They closed their eyes already when we had the coup against Mossadegh. They closed their eyes.
They usually close their eyes
when
the Americans...
In Chile.
Exactly.
But there have been differences already during the Iraq War. You saw Germany and France. They were not really happy with the decision, and there was no UN Security Council authorization. So we should not discard the transatlantic bonds.
Right.
But what I do think, of course, European states might find out they have their own interests as well, especially when it comes to the use of force, use of violence. After all, the European Union considered itself as a peace union from the from the start.
The whole point was that there would be no war.
Right.
Exactly.
So I should go back. It will be a process, but it might be possible.
Professor Gärtner, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you so much for our wonderful discussion that we had. I think we might have to do another one at some point, maybe the next season.
I'll come back to Tehran soon.
And next time you're in Tehran, inshallah, we can have another discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for the conversation.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Professor Gärtner? The US and NATO have once again successfully divided Europe and created a new Cold War against Russia by disregarding legitimate Russian strategic interests for decades and using any opportunity to provoke and humiliate Russia. Behavior which was criticized after the Cold War by none other than the father of Soviet containment policy, the late George Kennan, and which today is being criticized by none other than the still living Henry Kissinger. After NATO's humiliating defeat in its 20-year campaign in Afghanistan, this new Cold War and NATO expansion is a lifeline for the military-industrial complex in the United States, which requires permanent global war to justify its evil existence on this earth. Brainwashed Atlanticist European elites proudly reject the wishes of their own populations to proclaim their fidelity to NATO and their allegiance to the US, disregarding the real on-the-ground consequences of these policies for the daily lives of their own citizens. An unprecedented level of Russia-phobia and blatant in-your-face propaganda is sweeping the West, creating a suffocating atmosphere that gaslights and browbeats anybody who might dare to suggest that it is in Europe's real interest to have good relations with its massive neighbor, the Russian Federation, independent of what the US thinks of this. Once again, we come to understand that geopolitically, Europe is an American colony, physically and mentally occupied by one of the victors of World War II nearly 80 years ago. The Western rejection and isolation of Russia has been very good for Eurasian integration, the old nightmare of the British imperialists and their US inheritors, such as the late Zbigniew Brzezinski, creating a history-changing strategic alliance between the great Asian powers of Russia, China, and Iran in the global heartland. Of course, the old Anglo-American strategy is to separate Europe from Asia, to keep its European colony firmly in its own grip, and to divert Europe's wealth and resources towards its own military-industrial complex, depriving Europeans of the benefits of joining a new era in human history, the era of a strong and wealthy Eurasia. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time, on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Leader's remarks in graduation ceremony. A special graduation ceremony was held on Monday, 3rd of October, attended by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, where graduates of military colleges and universities received their degrees from Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Please stay with us for a special program on the remarks of the leader of the Islamic Revolution at the graduation ceremony of military cadets. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, attended the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Armed Forces on Monday, 3rd of October 2022. In the beginning of his speech, the leader described several thousand young people entering the army and the armed forces as an auspicious event, since each one of those young people breathes new life and inject a new spirit into the armed forces. He pointedly added, "The armed forces guarantee Iran's security and stability, and given the fact that Iran faces off against a coercive and bullying enemy, such as the United States, makes it even more imperative that Iran's armed forces are well-equipped with state-of-the-art technology." Ayatollah Khamenei went on to stress the fact that inbuilt security in the country is a great benefit and advantage. He poignantly added, "Our security has been generated completely from within and without relying on others. This security is completely different from the security that is provided by outsiders. In their hour of need, outsiders or foreigners would let them down. They either don't want to protect them or cannot protect them." He stressed that the security of the Islamic Republic of Iran is a result of its reliance on the power of God, the support of the Imam of the Age, may God hasten his reappearance, and the thinking and resistance of the nation and the armed forces. He also added, "If one relies on foreign powers, those same powers will leave them alone one day, because that foreign power neither wants to protect them nor can it protect them." In another part of his speech, the leader of the Islamic Revolution talked about how several thousand young people joined the military academies and organizers of the armed forces with enthusiasm and motivation every year. He said, "This is a great strength and good news, which brings a message of renewal and stability for the country." In further remarks, the leader said, "The presence of young Iranians in various scientific fields, in the economy, in politics, and in the military forces of the country is truly encouraging." Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader commented on recent events in Iran. In his first reaction to these events, Ayatollah Khamenei first of all expressed sorrow and sympathy in relation to the death of a young Kurdish woman, Mahsa Amini, whilst pointing out that the protests and rioting which accompanied this tragic event is in no way natural or spontaneous. The leader poignantly added, "No one has borne the brunt of recent events as much as members of the security forces, as much as the besieged volunteer force, or as much as the Iranian nation. The tyranny was imposed upon us. Of course, the Iranian nation, just like on numerous occasions in the past, showed its undoubted strength as usual. In future too, if the enemies attempt to disrupt Iranian society, the brave and faithful Iranian nation will confront them decisively, as they have done this time. Yes, the Iranian nation has been victimized, but it is strong and resilient. Just like our master, the commander of the faithful and the leader of the pious, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, who was the strongest of all and the one most victimized. From the leader's point of view, astute individuals have recognized that foreign hands are at work and foreign countries are behind recent events in Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei forthrightly stated, "I unequivocally declare that the United States, the fake Zionist regime, and those who follow them have planned and schemed and are behind recent events in Iran. Their agents and mercenaries and those who receive money from them are behind recent events, and they are being aided by some treacherous Iranians who live abroad." Asking what motivates foreign governments to incite rioting in Iran, the leader said, "They cannot accept Iran's advancement. They cannot stomach Iran's accelerating move towards progress. Some old obstacles hampering Iran's progress have been pushed aside. The country faces a lot of difficulties, though, and we still have a long way to go. But there is a serious effort to remove those obstacles on our way, and Iran is rapidly moving forward. Our enemies don't want to see this happen." Turning to manufacturing industry and high-tech knowledge-based companies, which are performing well at the moment, Ayatollah Khamenei pointedly said, "Factories which are operating at only half their capacity are now operating at full capacity. But our enemies want to stop this movement. They have planned and schemed. They have planned for our universities. They have planned for our streets. They don't want young people to attend university classes. And they want to start rioting and protests in this country." The leader also emphasized that foreign states have designed plans to busy the country's officials by creating new problems in the northwest and the southeast of the country. He said, "The enemy is wrong in its calculations about the northwest and southeast of the country. I have lived among the Baluch people, and they are very loyal to the Islamic Republic. The Kurdish people are also one of the most advanced groups among the Iranian people. They care about their homeland, they care about Islam, and they care about this system. Therefore, the enemy's scheme will not work, even though they will inject their poison." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei emphasized that the United States is not just against the Islamic Republic, it is also against a strong, independent Iran. He explained this by saying, "They're after the Iran of the Pahlavi era. Iran was to them a milking cow. The Shah submitted to their orders, and where in quandary, he often asked to see the US ambassador or the British ambassador to ascertain what course of action he should take. How can the Iranian nation tolerate this shame? This is what the enemies want. They are opposed to an independent, powerful Iran." In further remarks, the leader said, "The issue is not the issue of the death of a young girl or the issue of hijab or incomplete hijab. Many women who do not observe the hijab perfectly are among the steadfast and the most ardent supporters of the Islamic Republic, and they participate in various events. The issue and debate is about the independence, the resistance, the strength and the authority of the Islamic Republic of Iran."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thank you. In the mid-90s, the US was involved in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, but that was a nuclear arms race. Now, however, Washington is fighting another Cold War, with China this time, and in the digital space, a fight for technological superiority. In late August 2022, Washington restricted sales of high-end and sophisticated chips to China and Russia. Top chip designers based in the US have even reported that they have been told to limit sales of their high-end chips. One of the manufacturers, NVIDIA, one of the largest graphical process unit makers in the world, has even revealed through an SEC filing that Washington fears there is a risk that the products may be used militarily in China and Russia. The US says the restrictions are aimed at keeping advanced technologies out of the wrong hands. Meanwhile, China has slammed the restrictions, stating that the US is trying to impose a technological blockade. Beijing added that Washington aims to maintain its technological hegemony through the latest restrictions. The latest round of tensions between China and the US could also present an explanation for Washington's increasing interest in Taiwan. The Biden administration has so far tried to further strengthen its ties with Taiwan, and this has been clearly demonstrated in many cases, the two most notable being top US officials traveling there and Washington offering billions in subsidies to a Taiwanese company if it stops selling its advanced semiconductor chips to China. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, or TSMC, is the largest and most advanced chip manufacturing factory in the world. And Biden's push to stop the sales to Beijing only proves the US's aims that it seeks to impose a technological blockade and maintain or even strengthen its hegemony. The host of measures that Washington is taking to stop Beijing from getting its hands on high-end technology could amount to the biggest shift in US policy on shipping technology to China since the 1990s. The expansion of US powers to control exports of chips made with US tools to China is based on a broadening of the so-called Foreign Direct Product Rule. This is the same principle that gave the US authority to control the export of chips made overseas to Chinese telecoms giant Huawei Technologies, and later to stop the flow of semiconductors to Russia. But the question is whether this will be effective or will it backfire, similar to many other unilateral measures that the US has taken over the past years. Some experts say Washington's move will set the Chinese back, but some, including top American officials in the US, say the unilateral controls being put into place will lose effectiveness over time, and the effort could backfire if other countries don't join Washington. The most recent US blockade is aimed at preventing technology from being used by America's military rival. But these chips have a wide range of applications. Even if the blockade ends up being as effective as the US wants it to be, it is only a matter of time before China begins manufacturing its own high-end chipsets, as well as semiconductors, and eventually becoming self-reliant. It started in February 2022, and there seems to be no end in sight. While the Ukrainian military has made some advances, Russia still controls some 20% of the country, and there's nothing that suggests that this war is winding down. The Ukrainian military is backed up by Western weapons and Western intelligence gathering, which tells them where Russian soldiers are and where their bases are located. In the latest in its long list of support for Ukraine, the US Congress has passed another aid for Kiev, which amounts to some $12 billion. And this is on top of nearly $50 billion sent there in the past year. But apart from all the weapons, cash, and intelligence sent and given to Ukraine, reports are emerging that the U.S. has sent men on the ground there. A recent report released by an American news organization, The Intercept, stated that the U.S. Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Ukraine as part of a broad covert operation that includes CIA personnel. According to the report, before the Russian special military operation, the CIA believed Ukraine would fall quickly and so withdrew most of its forces and assets. But later on, as the war lengthened, the CIA began to believe that that wouldn't happen, and Washington sent its covert assets back into Ukraine. But all this back and forth between Russia and Ukraine and the West's unilateral support for Kiev has given rise to a new crisis, one which doesn't only involve the two warring sides anymore, and that is nuclear warfare. On Thursday, at a fundraiser in New York, U.S. President Joe Biden made an extraordinary and, as some say, highly alarming comments about the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war and the threat of a nuclear war. Biden said the risk of nuclear Armageddon is at its highest point since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. But the question which comes to mind is whether this admission is a result of the Biden administration's policy of supporting Ukraine in a war on Russia's border or Moscow's actions so far. Russian President Vladimir Putin has spoken out about using nuclear weapons, but never directly stated that he will use them. During his speech, however, Biden stated that Putin is not joking when he talks about the use of tactical nuclear weapons. The last time the U.S. was faced with such a situation was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which then President John F. Kennedy resolved through negotiations and striking a deal with Cuba. Biden, however, has so far shown no signs of walking back on its policies regarding Ukraine, and this has been clear in the U.S. not showing any interest in diplomacy and virtually cutting off all high-level talks. Not only this, Biden has time and again reiterated his support for Kiev, and the billions of dollars of aid is only a demonstration of the fact. Following the West's unconditional and unilateral support, Kiev has also pushed matters a step further and is now calling for strikes on Russia. Also, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, called for NATO to launch what he called a preventive strike on Russia to prevent Moscow from using nuclear weapons. But this has raised questions about Kiev's ambitions and the chances that the move would spark World War III and possibly a nuclear war. The Kremlin also responded to the comment and said Zelensky was trying to spark a world war. The remark gave birth to internal disputes in Kiev, with Ukrainian officials downplaying what Zelensky said. Now, as the world is faced with several economic, social, and environmental challenges, the warmongering aspirations of the US and its allies seem to have pushed humanity to the point of no return. But many, including Washington and Kiev, seem to be more focused on pushing their own agenda forwards, regardless of what's at stake.
As the crisis in Ukraine is getting worse, chances for a diplomatic solution to the war are looking slim. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has signed a decree that formally declares the prospect of any Ukrainian talks with Kremlin leader Vladimir Putin, quote, impossible. The decree also approves the decision of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council to strengthen Ukrainian defense. The decree came after Russia annexed four regions of Ukraine into its own territory. President Putin has just signed into law four unification treaties with the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, as well as the Kherson and Zaporozhye region. Russia says Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics split from Ukraine in 2014 following what Kremlin describes as the Maidan coup. Russia's decision to incorporate the regions into its own territory comes amid reports of Ukraine's military advances. According to President Zelensky, Ukrainian forces have retaken dozens of villages from Russia in the east and the south of the country. However, the latest maps revealed by Moscow showed Russian troops had already left many areas in Kherson and northeastern Kharkiv region.
Тільки за цю добу на Херсонщині від псевдореферендуму було звільнено і стабілізовано такі населені пункти, як Нововоскресенське, Новогригорівка і Петропавлівка. Рух продовжить.
Ukraine is now trying to make further inroads in the south and east before the colder weather arrives. Russia is trying to deploy the 300,000 reservists called up in a partial mobilization 2 weeks ago. But that would take some time before it can be operational. The developments come as the U.S. is sending more weapons into Ukraine.
This morning, President Biden spoke with President Zelensky to underscore that the United States will never recognize Russia's purported annexation of Ukrainian territory and will continue to support Ukraine as it defends itself from Russian aggression. President Biden informed President Zelensky that the United States is providing a new $625 million security assistance package to Ukraine as they continue to defend their country from Russia's invasion.
The new $625 million military package approved by the Biden administration includes additional weapons and equipment, including HIMARS, artillery systems and ammunition, and armored vehicles. The United States has now sent Ukraine more than $16.8 billion in military hardware. Russia has now warned that the shipment of new military hardware to Ukraine will risk direct confrontation with the United States. The supply of military products by the U.S. and its allies not only entails protracted bloodshed and new casualties, but also increases the danger of a direct military clash between Russia and Western countries. Concerns are now rising over a possible nuclear confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has already warned that his threat to use nuclear weapons is not a bluff. The war in Ukraine has already caused a crisis for the European Union. Energy prices have soared and the rising cost of living is putting many Europeans into poverty.
We have now to limit this inflationary impact of gas on electricity and everywhere in Europe. This is why we are ready to discuss a cap on the price of gas that is used to generate electricity. This cap would also be a first step on the way to a structural reform, an overall reform of our electricity market.
There are now signs that the support for Ukraine amongst Europeans is dropping. A survey by YouPinion's pollster has revealed that 60% of EU's population were on board with sending weapons to Kiev. The number was 64% back in March. It now appears that the lingering crisis in Ukraine could lead to social unrest across the continent. European leaders are concerned over the rise of far-right groups, which could potentially create cracks within the anti-Moscow coalition in Brussels.
Back in April, a temporary UN-mediated ceasefire was reached between Yemen's Ansarullah movement and the Saudi-led coalition. It was renewed twice, leading to a respite from a bloody war that has ravaged the country for years, killing 150,000 people. The Saudi kingdom and its allies, most notably the United Arab Emirates, have been waging a war against Yemen since March 2015, trying in vain to reinstall the exiled Saudi-friendly regime of Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi. The military campaign, which has been enjoying arms, logistic, intelligence and political support from the United States and some other Western countries, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and turned Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Now the truce has ended, with sides failing to reach a consensus about the renewal of the ceasefire. In his statement, the Ansarallah movement has blamed the impasse on the Saudi-led coalition's failure to live up to its commitments and its reluctance to address humanitarian issues as a top priority. It also slammed Saudi Arabia and its allies for their refusal to talk about measures that would alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people. Yemeni Foreign Minister Hisham Sharaf Abdullah also said the other side's failure to respond to the purely humanitarian demands presented by Sana'a has confirmed beyond any doubt its lack of seriousness in moving towards reaching a comprehensive and sustainable peaceful political settlement. Meanwhile, Yemen's armed forces have put oil companies operating in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on notice, warning that they could be targeted as long as Riyadh and its allies fail to commit to a proper ceasefire. Sana'a says the coalition has repeatedly violated the humanitarian and military armistice. On April 10th, only a week after the agreement came into force, the Saudi coalition committed over 1,600 violations, including offensive operations, airstrikes, overflights by warplanes, spy planes, and Apache helicopters, as well as missile and artillery targets, resulting in the death of a number of people. And until the end of the ceasefire on October the 2nd, the number of violations of the coalition forces has reached over 34,500. So, apparently from the very beginning, Riyadh and its allies were not serious and honest about efforts to end the war. UN has expressed its disappointment with the failure to extend Yemen's truce, saying negotiations are underway for a potential extension to the ceasefire, urging calm on the warring sides. But what will happen if the fighting resumes? The ceasefire has brought a sharp drop in fighting in the war, but now millions will once again be at risk of airstrikes, ground shelling, and missile attacks. Also, with the ceasefire in place, the daily lives of the Yemeni people dramatically improved. Fuel imports into the port of Hodeidah have quadrupled, while more essential goods entered the blockaded country and prices came down. In addition, the international charity Save the Children said the truce had led to a 60% decrease in displacement and a 34% drop in child casualties in Yemen. The Saudi-led military campaign had caused the internal displacement of 4.3 million Yemenis by March 2022. Humanitarian organizations have called on both sides to extend the arm of diplomacy, pointing out that 8 to 23 million people out of a total population of 30 million will be severely affected. So, if the humanitarian and military armistice is not renewed, everything will go back to square one. The risk of a large-scale famine, violence, collapsing services, and protracted displacement are the biggest challenges in Yemen now.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we briefly spoke about Imam Khomeini's first days in Nofel Chateau, a village around Paris, and the way his family, especially his wife, Ms. Sarafi, would handle the affairs in that village. Today we are going to continue the story. Stay with us, please. As we had said earlier, the Shah of Iran fled the country on January 16, 1979. and arrived in Aswan of Egypt. The news of his escape soon reached Paris, making Imam Khomeini's companions and many of the foreign journalists happy. Everyone was waiting for the Imam's reaction, but he only said, "Well," and there was no change in his face. The four-month period of Imam Khomeini's stay in France was a good opportunity to clarify and proclaim the Islamic Revolution's message to the world. Imam Khomeini used to make relations with religious people and arouse their sentiments in favor of the Iranian oppressed people. For instance, on the occasion of the new Gregorian year and the birthday of Prophet Jesus, the Imam sent a message to the Christians of the world and called Jesus as the reviver of the dead and the awakener of the sleep. He also called for the world Christians to pray for the Iranian nation. He wrote in his message, "I ask you, the Christian community, in your blessed days, to pray for our nation, which is caught by the unjust king, and appeal to God for their salvation. I ask you to warn the heads of some of the Christian countries who support the oppressive Shah with their satanic power and smash a nation under the pressure of oppression and make them familiar with the teachings of Prophet Jesus. I ask the Christian clergy to advise the heads of some of the powerful countries and denounce their support for those who have turned their back to the heavenly teachings." As Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, issued his message to the world Christians, his wife entered the scene of political activities more seriously. She says, "I had no specific duty in Nofelo Chateau until the Imam sent congratulatory message to the world Christians. As I was somehow aware of his Gnostic views, I felt it as a duty to elucidate the Imam's opinion so that some people would not think he had done a merely political job." Ms. Saqafi speaks about her life with Imam Khomeini. "In those days, I spent almost 100 hours in solitude and reviewed my life. I thank God more than 1,000 times for marrying a person whose thoughts are updated the older he becomes." As the Shah had escaped, the entire Iranian nation was waiting for the Imam's return to the country, but this decision faced many problems and obstacles. The Shah's premier was still in power and he might make problems for the Imam. Many of the politicians believed that the Imam's flight might be dangerous, while others maintained that he should return to the country as his presence among the people would accelerate the revolution's victory. Finally, Imam Khomeini made his mind to return to the country and Hajj Ahmad made the preparations for his trip. Thus, one night, he told his companions in Nofelo Chateau, "Once again, I apologize to all and I will soon go to Iran. There is the possibility of some dangers in this trip. Thus, I don't want anyone be at risk for my sake. I and Ahmad will go. If we reach Iran with no problem, we will meet each other in Iran, God willing. And if there is a danger for me, you should be present to continue the struggle." One of the attendants said, "You mean that you are not intent to take ladies in this trip? Was there no woman with Imam Hussein?" The Imam answered, "Imam Hussein was Imam Hussein. I don't want to accompany the ladies. As for the men also, I said that I don't like anybody to be in trouble for me."
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Khadija Saghafi says that the night of Imam Khomeini's farewell was not that hard, as his face was full of faith in God. She says, "It was not hard because by seeing the Imam's face, I was sure that there would be no problem for him and his companions. I was sad that I couldn't accompany him, yet I knew that if I accompanied him in the plane and Tehran, his attention would partly be drawn toward me. So I understood that if I do not accompany the Imam, he would be more comfortable and would not have any concern about me. However, I knew that his departure would make the village silent and gloomy, and I would be sad." Imam Khomeini and his companions landed at Mehrabad Airport in Tehran in the morning of February 2, 1979, and his wife and others joined him within 2 days. We will continue the story in the next episode.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. If you obey Allah in all of these different fields of your life, then you can say you are a true believer. Otherwise, faith merely in the sense of feeling an attachment to some principle or cause, but without this attachment being reflected in one's words or deeds, in one's limbs or behavior, is of no use. In fact, this is not something that Islam would even recognize as faith, Iman. This is the logic of the Quran. Be wary of Allah and settle your differences, and obey Allah and His Apostle, should you be faithful. Now, because the word faithful, mu'min, appears at the end of this verse, the next verse continues by describing the conditions one must meet to be faithful. The faithful are only those whose hearts tremble with awe when Allah is mentioned, and when His signs are recited to them, they increase their faith, and who put their trust in their Lord, who maintain the prayer and spend out of what we have provided them. It is they who are truly the faithful. They shall have ranks near their Lord, forgiveness and a noble provision. The Quran, Surah number 8, verse 2 to 4.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Here the Quran lays out five qualities that one who is truly faithful will possess. It is possible that not all of these will be on show to others. However, anyone who is trying to cultivate these five qualities in themselves is on the path of faith. They are pursuing faith and worthy of the title faithful. A true believer will have these five qualities. First, the faithful are only those, إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ الَّذِينَ This shows that only the people with these qualities count as faithful, whose hearts tremble when Allah is mentioned. What does it mean for their hearts to tremble? In what sense are they afraid of Allah? Are they like a criminal who is afraid of a judge? Or is fear here something more subtle than this? Someone might say, I haven't done anything wrong and I'm not afraid of Allah. Of course, the only person who is afraid of a judge is someone who has committed a crime for which they deserve to be punished. But if someone is innocent, they will not be afraid. But again, what person can be sure that they have no sins? However, there is another kind of fear, one that does not spring from guilt but from knowledge. When a person comes face to face with something great and magnificent, they feel awe and wonder.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Thousands of Muslims have held a gathering in Pakistani capital Islamabad to celebrate the birth anniversary of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad.
The occasion is one of the key festivities on the Islamic calendar and holds a special significance for the Muslims around the world. The same goes for the people of Pakistan, who are always excited about commemorating this day.
The participants in the ceremonies say that the day provides Muslims with a great opportunity to understand the teachings and the message of Prophet Muhammad.
Prophet's teachings are still resonating in the society. This is a time to remember and follow the teachings of our Prophet and his family, who dedicated their lives for the great cause of Islam.
This day reminds us of the message of the Holy Prophet. He teaches us to forget our differences and live in peace and harmony with a sense of brotherhood.
In Islamabad, many of the public and private buildings, as well as streets, markets and mosques, are decorated with buntings and illuminated to mark the auspicious occasion. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Green flags reading, "We are here, O Prophet of God," decorated the capital Sana'a to mark Prophet Muhammad's birth. Those who attended said this year's celebration is of high significance, given the perilous times Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world are experiencing. Some participants argued that there is a war being waged against the message of Prophet Muhammad and those who follow him.
We're here to send a message to the world and our enemies that our Islamic nation will never abandon our beloved Prophet and that we will always follow his path and the examples of our leaders from the Prophet's household.
The leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, also addressed the nation, calling for Islamic unity and adherence to the Holy Book of Quran and the message of Islam in an effort to improve the Muslim world. He condemned those who are in favor of normalizing ties with Israel and deemed them as traitors of Allah and His Messenger. Al-Houthi also called on the West to end their animosity towards God and all of His messengers. The Ansarullah leader also called on the Saudi-led coalition to end their war on Yemen, while also renewing his call to Yemenis to continue their resistance. The birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad comes 1 week after the ceasefire between Yemen and Saudi Arabia officially ended, without reaching an agreement to end the war. Since then, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has sent numerous warnings to Saudi Arabia and the UAE to end the war and lift the blockade, or else face, quote, unprecedented consequences.
While millions of Yemenis take to the streets to commemorate the birth anniversary of God's final messenger, the message being delivered here is that the Maulid is not only a day of celebration, it is also a day of resistance against the decades of Western neocolonialism aimed at dominating Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
U.S. President Joe Biden has signed a new classified policy that limits the country's drone operations and tightens the rules of engagement. This policy will limit drone operations in several countries where the U.S. has carried out many strikes in recent years, including Afghanistan. U.S. drones, however, are still flying in the skies of Afghanistan, and people are worried that deadly strikes could still happen any moment.
Of course, in this case, people are receiving the harsh impacts more than the government. Such attacks create mental conditions for us. We don't feel safe and always feel threatened. When they fly over our sky, they make the days and nights horrific.
Surely the drones make us worry. We know they have special targets, but we have also seen civilians being targeted too. When we hear them flying, we get scared, especially the children.
Back in 2017, the Trump administration replaced old guidelines with a looser set of rules for drone engagement that led to a 330% rise in civilian casualties in Afghanistan. A research by an independent media organization shows that from 2015 to 2020 alone, between 300 to 900 civilians lost their lives to U.S. drone operations. Experts say that even with the new policy adopted, U.S. drones in Afghanistan are still dangerous.
The U.S. government, according to its hegemonic dominance worldwide, is always after fulfilling their national interests. If their national interests require it, drone attacks could take place anyway. According to the policy, the attack permit only goes to a higher authority rather than commanders. Biden would sign the attack permit.
The aforementioned policy requires near certainty that a target is a member of a designated terrorist group and near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured before pulling the trigger. But it still remains unclear what this near certainty standard means in practice.
The precision of U.S. drone attacks in Afghanistan has always been under question. There have been many examples of misguided U.S. strikes. Notably, an attack just before the withdrawal of U.S. forces last year that killed 10 members of a family. People here are still concerned that they might be the next target. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
I'm heading with Donbass militia fighters to a frontline position outside the city of Donetsk. Ukrainian soldiers are only 70 meters away. I'm told not to film the skyline or any prominent markers so as not to give away their positions. The cramped living quarters are dark and dank. A fighter with the call sign Yidra, meaning the otter, gives me a tour.
We live here not in trenches but under concrete. These are destroyed buildings that we've old basements. It is all dug out by hands, down the narrow passageways and understand what it's like to be a miner. We live here, breathe this air. You can't survive our